As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
To the Total Soccer Show and another listener questions episode, dropping like a Drake album in the feeds of all those certified lover boys and girls out there. Did I sound hip and cool and young when I said that?
You did until the very end of that.
Mission accomplished. My name is Ryan Bailey. Joining me today is a man who's not been the subject of a 200 million euro bid from Real Madrid. You just heard his voice, Taylor Rockwell.
I mean, like, there's still time. We could see what happens. I don't know who they'd be negotiating with, and I do feel like any one of the three of you would happily part with me for 200 million pounds.
At this point, I shall reveal I am your agent, Taylor, yes.
Oh, that's good. I probably need one of those. So, all right, I'm going to send Ryan Bailey out to do all my negotiating from now on.
Yeah, first order of business, I take 75%. Deal.
Yeah, that's troubling. That's troubling. But you know what? Fair. Fair is fair. As long as you're quality, let's make it happen.
Get what you pay for. Also here is a man who's not been sold back to his old club by Barcelona for a fraction of what was paid for him. It's Joe Lowry.
Oh, my word. That deal and everything. I shouldn't be surprised at what happens with FC Barcelona at this point. But somehow I still am. Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me every time, still shame on me. I don't know what was going on with Barcelona, what has been going on. But that deal is insane.
So to paraphrase a tweet from Liam Twomey, on Twitter to explain that, Barcelona have sold Antoine Griezmann back to Atletico for 40 million euros. That's just 2 years after paying 120 million euros. It's quite a lot more. It's three times more. So that's decided. That's a transfer fee that they funded originally by taking out a short-term 35 million euro bank loan and mortgaging 85 million on future income. Goodness me. What a world. Wrong club. What a wrong club, Graham.
Yep, absolutely.
I've just jumped the gun and introduced Graham Ruthven there, who has not been given the you are here and you're not wearing the number 10 shirt of Barcelona, unfortunately. That's been given to someone else.
It's been given to Ansu Fati. I'm not a fan of that at all. The pressure. He's coming off a long-term injury. The pressure on that poor kid is going to be immense. But he's good, so let's see how he does.
You think they give it like one season without having to tend? Why did they have to basically... Messi's locker's barely cold and they just...
Yeah, that shirt's still warm.
The shirt is still warm indeed, and asymmetrical as it is, Taylor.
Graham, is the pressure that it's just like simply the number 10 for Barcelona, or is it that it's Messi's number 10?
That is Messi's, yeah.
Okay.
I know, that is so soon after he's left as well. I genuinely would have, Ryan and I talked about it, I think, on last week's listener questions. I wouldn't have retired the jersey, but I certainly would have left it for a while, just so that pressure isn't so crippling. And if you're going to give it to someone that if you mess up their career, it's not going to be that catastrophic and that damaging. But if you mess up Ansu Fati's career, yeah, I'll never forgive you, Barcelona.
Yeah.
So you're saying, like, just give it to an academy kid? Like, hey. Yeah. Like, 13-year-old, you're our number 10 now. Good luck.
Scruffy the janitor's getting number 10. All right. We actually covered
Martin Braithwaite is getting number 10. That's who they probably were going to give it to.
Last week's listener questions, if you listened to it with Graham and I, we did cover this, and I said that they should retire Messi's shirt and all other numbers. Like, it just should be like Batman symbol and poop emoji. Like, it should just go different. That's what I think.
I mean, I think you want to be innovative. Like, there's much discussion today about generic team names. Maybe you want to go non-generic numbering, Ryan. I'm in on it. I like this style.
Excellent. I like that you like my style as your agent in our second order of business, Taylor.
75%, baby.
Listener questions time. We've got plenty to get through today. Shall we get started, gents? Let's get started. I answered my own question. Richard Rolson, the alliteratively resplendent Richard Rolson, asks, Daniel Levy has been chairman of Tottenham Hotspur for just over 20 years. In that time, they've risen to be considered one of the, in quotes, large European clubs, but have not been able to make that final step of winning either the Premier League or a European competition. Considering everything, the stadium, the training grounds, the various levels of success, has Daniel Levy been a good steward for Tottenham Hotspur? So Daniel Levy is celebrating his, or I don't know what he's doing, but he's been 20 years in the gig. He took over from Lord Alan Sugar in 2000-2001 season, February of that year. He was the youngest chairman in the league at that point, so kind of deemed as a risky appointment in that sense. Previously, prior to that, he was non-executive director at Glasgow Rangers. And now he's the longest serving chairman in the Premier League. I'm going to start off here by saying I think it's an absolute net positive from Daniel Levy's time at Tottenham Hotspur, and there's plenty of reasons for it. That first season, 2000-2001, they finished 12th. Before that, 10th, 11th, 14th, 10th. So they were kind of an average middle-of-the-road Premier League team before he came in. In those 20 years, gents, got them into the Champions League, got them a trophy, League Cup 2008. Got them a new stadium. Got them one of the best training grounds in the country. Got them some pretty decent players. Gareth Bale, Luka Modric, Son, Dele, Eriksen. He helped with all those deals. He got them into the Big Six as it has become. He got them into the Super League for almost 2 days. And probably most importantly, he's kept them financially stable as well. Who's going to come at me and say you're going to criticise Daniel Levy and for what he's done? Taylor, what you got?
I don't know if I'm going to criticize, because honestly, you made a really compelling argument there. And I think I am more focused on the more recent history than the long-term history. And you're right, like, that it is even a Big Six is probably a sign that he has done some pretty impressive work to make Tottenham what they are. And for a period of time, it felt like that they were the club that were most on the rise, that were going to kind of achieve new heights and break in and become this consistent top four contender, or maybe even like title contender. I think a lot of that was, for me, rooted in Pochettino and the way that sort of burnt out, and then the search for a new manager this summer and the All or Nothing documentary and the Super League. Those things, I think, loom large in my like current memory. But then to think about, like, he's also the man who I was sort of, as a Man United fan, not excited when we had to negotiate with Spurs for a player, because if it's Carrick or if it's Berbatov, you know that he is going to get every single thing he wants and will not sort of break from his stance. And I remember him as being this super tough negotiator, and that made it really weird to see him essentially fawning all over Jose Mourinho in that documentary.
Yeah. Joe, where do you stand on the Daniel Levy situation, being a good steward for Tottenham? I suppose, as Taylor mentioned and inferred there, you could question his treatment of some of his managers. Sacking Martin Jol at halftime of a game, interesting move. I think maybe the biggest one that Tottenham fans might cite is not backing Pochettino with enough cash when the team had real momentum. Joe, any thoughts?
Yeah, it's frustrating for Tottenham fans, and I can understand them being frustrated that they're not in the Liverpool, City, Manchester United, Chelsea stratosphere right now, and really haven't been for the last couple of seasons. But I love the idea that you brought up, Ryan, about where they were when he first took over, right? It has been a massive improvement in terms of results. They made a Champions League final, right? That's a big deal. And 20 years ago, or you know, back in 2001, that was not in the cards at all. So I think overall, if you're looking at it in a macro sense, he has been a good steward of this club. I also, looking at it in a financial sense, in terms of the club's valuation, Tottenham's value has skyrocketed in the last 20 years. When Levy took over as chairman, the club was valued at about £80 million. That's a few years before he took over. That was back in 1998. Now the valuation is somewhere, and it depends on where you're reading, but somewhere between 1 and 2 billion pounds. And part of that, sure, is because the football industry is just ballooning, right? But also part of that is because they've been run in a fairly responsible way. The stadium, the new stadium, and the debt that comes with that is a bit of an interesting situation. But overall, I think it's hard to look at this change in Tottenham and not see the fact that Levy has stewarded them quite well.
I'm with you there, Joe. Graham, what do you think about this? I'm just trying to think of some negatives, and I think there is the thing with the managers. There's maybe like the bail money wasn't well spent. There's that was dragging out some transfers as well, like the Berbatov one.
The bail reinvestment is the thing that comes to mind for me. But I think Daniel Levy is absolutely a net positive for Spurs. And going back to this has been mentioned a few times, going back to where Spurs were when he took over. When he took over in 2001, those were my formative years as a football fan. So the impressions that I have of clubs from 2001, the early 2000s, are really difficult to shake because I was 10 years old at that time. So that's when I'm really starting to get into football. At that time, I saw Spurs in the same way that I see Aston Villa now. Like, they were an Aston Villa club. Yeah. Like, a big team with the potential to break into that top six or the top end of the table, but more often than not mid-table, generally underachieving for their size. So like 20 years on, for them to be where they are now has to be a positive. Like that, he has to have done a good job. 20 years is also a long time, so he's going to make mistakes. You know, I think, you know, hiring Mourinho, and I didn't get that at all. Not just sacking Pochettino. Maybe that was the right thing to do. Maybe that was the end of a cycle. You know, they started the season poorly. Pochettino seemed to be very frustrated. Maybe it was the right time for Pochettino to go. However, the mistake was hiring Jose Mourinho, who Daniel Levy seemed to have this fascination for, and it didn't really line up at all, and it was a bit of a disaster. That's a mistake. The bail money being reinvested poorly was a big mistake as well, and that set back Tottenham, you know, a good couple seasons until kind of Pochettino comes along. So he's made mistakes. But for a club that isn't Liverpool or Manchester United, with the kind of historical advantage that they have, that natural prestige that they have, for a club that isn't Liverpool or Manchester United, a club that doesn't have the backing of a Gulf state or a Russian oligarch, I think Levy has got Tottenham competing as much as realistically possible. I mean, yes, they could have done a Leicester or something, but that's you can't count on anything like that. For them to be up there consistently, I think has to be an achievement.
Yeah. I think you all are making very good arguments. The thing that I think still struggle with and welcome your thoughts on is, to Graham's point about Jose Mourinho, I feel like that was I've got to get this guy. I believe that he can like be the next step for this club. He's a name. He's going to kind of catapult us into this next stratosphere. And that doesn't happen. And maybe I'm like talking nonsense. And obviously I don't know what's going on behind the scenes at Spurs, but it almost feels to me like he has lost a little bit of that mojo, a little bit of that like self-belief, and the intimidating negotiator, and he's going to draw these transfers. Like, it's annoying if you're a fan of the club who's trying to buy the player, but it also makes those clubs less likely to try to pillage Tottenham, which is where I think they maybe were, and he has made them a club that can't be easily taken apart. If you're going to have to buy one of their players, it's going to be a lot of money. And so that's all really strong. He has this like keen reputation, but then following Mourinho, I don't know if y'all read the piece from The Athletic about their search for a manager and how many people they went through. And it's not even really a logical, like, oh, that didn't work. Oh, he signed there. Oh, he said it's very like, oh, maybe that guy. No, not that guy anymore. Okay. We're going to hire this guy instead. We're going to hire, Paratici to like do the search for us midway through, and we're going to start it back over. And they kind of keep going back to Erik ten Hag and then never being convinced. And by the time they decide maybe he is the one for us, they can no longer get him. And that all just felt so chaotic and shambles that it's hard for me to let go of that or forget about that, because that's such an ongoing thing. And I really like Nuno, but we don't know if that's going to end up being a positive or not yet. And I think that is a big aspect of this for me.
As much as I do think Levy has done a good job over the last 20 years, I think his tenure will be defined by what happens next, by the post-stadium years. Yes. Because so much has been about building Tottenham up to a point where they have, you know, Joe's talking about the valuation, 1.6 billion, I think it is, valuation. They have the probably the best football stadium in Europe now, this mega spaceship of a stadium. They have one of the best training grounds in. So they've got all the assets now in place. And it's similar to how Arsenal kind of built themselves up to that point. And now, obviously, you're looking at all that they did and all they sacrificed. You know, Arsenal couldn't spend money in the transfer market. Levy might argue that's why he didn't back Pochettino at the time, because that was coinciding with the construction of the new stadium. If all that sacrifice is for nothing, then I think Levy's legacy is tainted. However, if they continue to build and to the point where they're just permanent members of the top four, they're challenging for titles, then it's just going to add to what I think has been a very good job of overall.
Yeah. I think on balance, though, I think what you said there, Graham, that the proof is in the pudding about he's been there 20 years, longest serving chairman. You know, Premier League teams generally don't suffer falls in the chairman position, generally. So I think it's very much a proof of his excellent work there. And I think we can all agree that most of his value comes from the fact that we saw in the All or Nothing documentary that he sits and has his meals with the players in the training ground. So I just love the idea of him in the last few weeks sitting opposite Harry Kane, locking eyes as he eats his Cheerios. Wonderful. Wonderful.
He wants that convivial atmosphere, Ryan. That was a big thing he talked about with their next manager, which, there you go. I mean, like, maybe that is in response to Jose Mourinho. But Graham, I totally agree with you that I think we'll know maybe in 5 years, like, a much clearer picture, because with the stadium being as it is, as you mentioned, but also just in London. So it's like this stadium where, like, if you're going to do a giant, like, arena concert, decent chance you're doing it there, and they're going to have that income. They're going to have that money coming in.
The NFL.
Yeah, and the NFL, a big one. So, like, post-COVID, when you start getting crowds and people can go back to things, then there will be more money coming in. They will be able to buy more players. And going back to that Athletic article, if you believe it, which I guess I do, it sounds like Pochettino was down to come back and was maybe really interested in leaving PSG pretty quickly. And PSG said, no, that's not happening. And so there he stays. But there is a world in which we go back to normal, hopefully. There are fans in the stands. There are NFL games. There's other stuff happening. There's money there. And then Pochettino comes back and rebuilds that squad again. And maybe they are this powerhouse that I thought they were going to be. I think maybe we just might be talking about them in a little bit of a down period.
Well, let's come back and review this in 5 years' time so we get more of the post-stadium consensus. It'll be called the Jacksonville Jaguars Stadium presented by T-Mobile by that point. Yep. But we'll still get a good idea of what's going on at Tottenham there. Thank you, Richard, for the question. Let's get another one in before we go for a break. This one, a question from a friend of the show, the only certified rock star that I know who listens to this show, Mr. Adam Kiefer. Hello, Adam. As a Barcelona fan, I'm missing somebody very special right now. No, not him, says Adam. It's Ray Hudson. Can we just take a minute to pour one out for the end of Ray Hudson and La Liga? Well, La Liga's still going and Ray Hudson is, but I get what he's saying there. Instead of cries of magisterial, now it's just a generic British guy telling me somebody should have done better with that. Alas, that's a question from Adam.
Is that not just you, Ryan?
It's pretty much mirroring my exact thoughts. Yes, indeed. If you do need your Ray Hudson fix, by the way, he can now be heard on the Inter Miami calls, which is still very enjoyable. La Liga now being on ESPN Plus, of course. A Copa del Rey is there as well. I've got to say, I like the ESPN Plus team. They've got Ian Dark, Derek Ray, Adrian Healy, Sebastian Salazar's on there too. And you get that Ian Dark and Macca, Steve McManaman combo, that delightful combo of the pre-NBC Premier League days as well. Taylor, where do you stand on Ray Hudson? I love him personally, but I understand he's Marmite in that some people love him, some people don't.
I think you have just reached phase three of Ray Hudson. I think there are three phases. I think the first one is when you first hear him. And like when I was teaching in Turkey, I remember one of my friends was a Barca fan and would always show his students Ray Hudson commentary because it was just so ridiculous and they always loved it. And that was like an exercise he would use. And like, how do you come up with ridiculous metaphors? And so there's that initial phase of he's hilarious and amazing. Then after a few games, it becomes like, oh, he's still calling it magisterial. He's still referring to like seal backs as being slippery. And there's like a, we get it, Messi's very good sort of phase. And then you push through that to get to phase three, which is, man, this guy's just great. And he is just so fun. And you're right, Ryan. Those Inter Miami broadcasts, like that team is also shambles, my second usage of shambles in this episode. but he makes them a more fun team to watch because any little moment, any step over or nutmeg, you know he is going to erupt into enthusiasm. And it does kind of raise the energy a bit. So I am with you. I think he's great.
I was watching an Inter Miami game a couple of weeks ago. It's probably one of the games that we talked about in the weekend review. He described a Rodolfo Pizarro goal as a gangster goal. I have no idea what that meant, but it was brilliant. I loved it.
Have you not seen Scarface, Graham?
Okay. I have, but I'm struggling to join the dots there. But I don't care. It was brilliant. It was the best gangster goal I've ever seen in my life.
You didn't see the part where Pizarro ran over and just put his face into a mound of flour in an homage to Scarface? That's what he was referring to.
I missed that bit.
His celebration was, "You cockroaches want to play rough?"
That's great. That was a good Tony Montana, Ryan.
Thank you very much. I do try.
You know what? 77%, just because of that. Well done.
Yes. Oh my gosh. What a day for me. Joe, how do you feel about Ray Hudson? I don't want to make this a judgment on Ray Hudson or not, but I certainly miss his calls. I do miss his calls on the league, I should say, and I miss him specifically talking about Messi, because those noises, those squeals of ecstasy you'd hear from him on the call behind Phil Shane occasionally, as if he was having what Victorian women might have called a hot flush.
I am in phase three of Ray Hudson, as Taylor put it. I really enjoy listening to him call games, him talking about Indiana Vasilev and using Indiana Jones in there with Inter Miami. And then, yeah, all the Messi stuff. It's so, 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 so good. I pulled out three of my favorite Ray Hudson Messi quotes in preparation for this question. Lionel Messi, you could drop a tarantula into his shorts and he'd still be cool. Defenders try to follow him on Facebook and he comes out on Twitter. That's how evasive he is. That one's so good. And this one might be my favorite. He soaks up the defenders like a paper towel soaks up milk. I mean, come on, guys. Anyone
he just
who doesn't
milk that day. That's all that
probably.
Is.
Probably. He's like, oh, paper towel, Messi. Ah, I'm going to use that later. I mean, how do you not love Ray Hudson? I am genuinely bummed that he's not calling these games for ESPN Plus, for ABC, for ESPN. I just think that's a mistake, and maybe there's reasons behind it. Maybe he didn't want to do it. I don't know. I don't know Ray Hudson personally, but the team that ESPN Plus has assembled has some commentators I really like. They have some commentators that I don't enjoy as much. But man, Ray Hudson would have been the star of the show alongside Lionel Messi, even though he's gone now.
There is an irony as well that Messi's still on BN.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that wow. The legal rights have gone to. That's right, isn't it? They're still
right.
League is on BN Sports. Yeah,
that's right.
Come on,
yeah.
BN, give Ray a call. Get the old team back together.
That's not a bad shout. I suspect the reason he didn't go to ESPN Plus, and I'm speculating here, is that he is a man who loves South Florida, and that's where BN were and are based, and maybe ESPN Plus are very much not in that area of the country, which they are not. I used to host a Sirius XM radio show on Sunday mornings, which approximately 3 to 4 people listened to, which is why I don't do it anymore. But Ray often used to very kindly come on and guest with us, and he was always a great laugh. I'll always remember one time where most of the interview was describing an iguana that had just got into his house in Miami, and ended up describing players and relating them to this iguana that was in his house for most of the time. So,
right,
yeah.
Is his normal speaking voice like the same as his broadcast voice? Because his broadcast voice reminds me of a car that is out of gear. Like it's very like high pressure, high intensity. Is that just how he talks, or is he a little bit more mellow in normal conversation?
We spoke on Sunday mornings, and I think he was a little more mellow, but still very much with all the similes and everything. They were all very much in there. So that is I think he must script some of them, but a lot of them are off the cuff, I think, from what I can see. I also interviewed him for an Athletic piece I wrote about the NASL. I spoke to Rodney Marsh and a few other Brits who came over to play in the NASL, and he was charming for that as well. And he was talking about his early days playing with Newcastle, and that led me to ask you, Graham, in the UK, are people aware of Ray Hudson, or is it just that online clips of his calls have circulated? Is it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of Twitter bubble thing, but certainly British European football fans know of his calls. You know, like a number of his commentary pieces have gone viral after Messi goals. It tends to be Messi goals, I have to say, and I think he's played quite a significant role in the. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but he played quite a significant role in the appeal of Messi in the United States, you know, and that those clips do tend to go viral. And I'm a big believer that commentary is so important to the broadcast of good goals and good soccer moments. I mean, can you imagine the obvious one is Aguero's goal without Martin Tyler's call, or Manchester United winning the treble without Clive Tildesley going and Solskjaer's won it. So I do think commentary is really important to the appeal of those moments. And Hudson on Twitter and in social media circles, you know, he was perfect for those messy moments.
Graham, that's such a really interesting point, because, like, do you know who Joe Buck is?
Not familiar, I have to say.
I think he does baseball, but he definitely does football. And there was a while back, there was like a montage of a person doing a Joe Buck impression, but calling historical events. But it's just the way he does the games, which is just like, oh, the Hindenburg has exploded. Like, it's very calm and normal. And like, you're right that it doesn't lend itself to those highlight moments. You need that level of like, I can't believe that just happened. And Ray Hudson definitely brings that.
He does indeed. Adam, thank you very much for the question. Ray Hudson, thank you very much for being you. We'll be back after this break with more.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Well, luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, we're back. We are taking your listener questions. Here's one from James Chocker. Thank you very much for getting involved, James. Who is the best poophouser in the US MNT pool, asks James. And for the definition of poophousery, just to emphasize it there, we've censored that word, by the way, but it's a term for underhand conduct, gamesmanship in soccer. Well, you know, trying to gain an advantage with the dark arts, basically. Diving, cheating, time-wasting, nasty tackles. Think Sergio Ramos. Basically, that's what it is.
The good stuff.
The good stuff. All the good stuff that makes this little game of ours a bit more spicy and a bit more fun. Joseph, USMNT Paul, who be doing that poophousery?
So I've got two primary names. I'm really curious to hear who Taylor has, and then Ryan and Grimm, if you guys have any thoughts as well. But I've got Kellen Acosta first. He is always making friends with the ref. He is always trying to slow down the penalty kick procedure for the opposition that happened in the Gold Cup. It happens a lot for Kellen Acosta. He is not afraid to get in there and get dirty. I think Watke did a video, Chris Russell on Twitter did a video about this. And he also did a video about Matthew Hoppe, who stared a guy down against Mexico in the Gold Cup final. He didn't do the Allen Iverson step over, but it was over on the near sideline, and he kind of bodied this opponent to the ground and then stared him down and walked away slowly, and then he actually walked away. But those two players, Acosta and Hoppe, are 1 and 2. I don't know which order. Maybe it's 1A, 1B. I don't know who's on top. But both of those guys have shown some poophousery ability and I think have a pretty high poophousery ceiling long term.
The poophousery index is high then, Joe. That's what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. It's okay. That's the second best metric just after the Audi player index or whatever it's called.
Taylor.
Yeah, I had Acosta for the same reasons as Joe. I had Matthew Hoppe because he is just that, like, he's going to scrap. He's going to leave a boot in. He's not going to back down. Matt Miazga is similar.
Oh,
like, there's the Diego
Reyna's
moment that is very much an iconic photo. But I think what I found in thinking about this question is that tends to be, like, the greatest housery experts tend to be veterans. They tend to be people who know how to, like, manipulate a ref or manipulate a moment. And that is Pepe or Sergio Ramos or Rafa Marquez. And I think the lack of long-term veterans with this current national team means that you have those little moments. I think Weston McKennie is one who's had a few in, like, he tends to be the victim of housery, if anything, but there are definitely some, like, tackles that he goes in for. He definitely will wade into a scrap, and I think he knows how to frustrate. But the name that I landed on is Greg Berhalter, the current manager, because he has been there as a player and is now the manager, and he knows, I think, a lot of the dark arts and a lot of what CONCACAF, especially CONCACAF Away, is all about. He went through it himself as a player, and so he just has those little jabs here and there. He had one recently with Mexico where he talked about in the Gold Cup final, like, I hope we get good officiating and, like, that this game is played according to the rules, when he himself has plenty of times complained about the ref and gotten in the ref's face. And I think he's pretty good about being very friendly with people. He always seems to be, like, slapping a player on the back as they're about to sub on. And I'm talking about opposition players. And there is an element of gamesmanship there and just sort of maybe just being like, hey, man, great. Good luck today. Hope you do really well. And it's just, I don't know. I find that instead of being cheerful, I sometimes think that is more dark arts than anything else. So those are my four that I had on my list.
Hey, Berhalter's also a Jersey boy, Taylor. So
going
back to our conversation yesterday, maybe there's a tie-in.
Mm-hmm. There definitely is.
I think you guys have hit many nails on many heads there. I think, is there a fine line between petulance and poophousery in some instances?
Yes.
Because
yeah.
I was thinking maybe, can we put Pulisic in the category at all?
Anyway. That was the one that, I mean, obviously I don't have the knowledge of Taylor and Joe, but when I go through the squad, the most recent squad, you know, it's full of players that I know, and Pulisic, I feel like he's maybe not there yet, but he's got it in him, doesn't he? He's got a bit of poophousery in him. And so maybe that's a role he'll grow into. I mean, is the USA's problem that you don't have enough poop houses?
Yeah.
Like, just imagine if all the best athletes in America became poop houses instead of playing football or basketball. Is that not how that old argument goes?
It is. You nailed it, right? Nailed it, Graham. I think that should be your next Eurosport piece.
You'd be World Cup winners by now.
Well, you say it in jest, Graham, but that's kind of the point made in last week's listener question. So when we were asked about poophousery as well and how some of the very best teams in the world are experts at it, and it's not a detriment to a team, it's very much an addition. You think about Pep Guardiola teams, for example, who have their middle-of-the-park poophouse expert in their team. And with the US-17 not having that edge, if we can call it that, perhaps, Taylor, that does work to their detriment a little bit.
I mean, well, I think it depends on what we're talking about, because to the point of it being petulance, that is where, like, I'm fine with not having that, because that's how you boil over and get a red card. I think, though, that to play, I really do believe that playing away in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying, you have to deal with it so much that it's almost impossible for it not to rub off and for you not to learn some lessons from it. And the U.S. could definitely be more ruthless with it, but I also see plenty of American players, like, you know, just checking their cleats on the penalty spot before a penalty is taken and getting in, like, opponents' faces in a very scrum way without actually throwing a punch or ever kicking out or anything like that. The last player who I remember would sort of toe that line and occasionally overstep is Jermaine Jones. And I do miss Jermaine Jones. I do love Jermaine Jones with the national team, but I also think that sometimes that would veer into, like, uh-oh, that's unpredictable, Jermaine. We don't need that. And if it's predictable, if it's understandable housery, then I'm more okay with it. And sure, then let's get some of that. I think Gio Reyna is also probably a person who can embrace that philosophy a bit.
Yeah. And if we are going back into previous pools, Clint Dempsey? Has he got some poop housery about him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt. I mean, pretty much every player from like 94 to 90, probably 2002, I would say did. like you can find plenty of video of it. And then I think Clint Dempsey is definitely one who knew how to sort of frustrate without actually throwing hands.
Excellent. I love that we're getting so many poophousery questions for listener questions at the moment. And that everyone's embracing our nomenclature of poophousery as well. Thank you very much, James, for the question there. Matt Koss has got a question for us. Not Matt Goss from Bros, Matt Koss. Would Christian Pulisic make and at least as a sub make... Sorry, I'm going to try that again. Matt Koss has got a question for us. Would Christian Pulisic make and at least be a sub on any national team? Any national team, gents. This is Christian Pulisic, who doesn't always make his own domestic team. Can he make every national team, Taylor?
No, but it's closer than I thought it was. I would have said yes until I thought about it a little bit more. And like when you look at the players that were left off the Euro squads, like there's not a huge list of people that were like obvious omissions in a very like, oh, that would have changed everything way. And I think then that Pulisic was probably, yeah, he plays for Chelsea. He gets regular enough minutes that he probably makes a ton of teams, but that he is an attacker is the only knock against him, because is he making Brazil's like attacking squad? I don't know if he is. Maybe the same for Argentina. That one's tougher, but I think if he were a defender, like, and doing what he has done, he is absolutely starting or playing games for pretty much every national team, I'd say.
Yeah, but I suppose he's not a defender is the point there. I sort of looked through some of the major teams and thought where he would fit. You know, teams who don't necessarily have a lot of depth at right wing or maybe left wing or attacking midfield. Brazil is one maybe he could do if Gabriel Jesus wasn't played on the right wing. I think he could certainly get in there. Argentina, I don't think Angel Di Maria's given up there necessarily. Maybe could go on the left over. Who would be on the left? Lo Celso? I don't know. So maybe make there. Like someone like Italy, I don't think he's... I think they've got enough midfield depth.
But are we talking about getting on in the team, the 11, or as the squad? Well, because there's countless nations where he wouldn't get in the team. But in terms of the squad, the only country I looked through and I was like, he wouldn't get in that squad was actually, it pains me to say this, but was England. Yeah. Rashford, Sancho, Sterling, Grealish, even Saka at this moment, I'm not convinced he gets in that squad over Saka. But, you know, I looked at France, you know, and my instant reaction was to go, well, he wouldn't get in the France squad, would he? Because everyone thinks that's the most stacked squad in world football. So I looked through their Euro squad, you know, Griezmann, okay, fair enough. Coleman, fair enough. Mbappe, fair enough. But then you've got Marcus Thuram, who's a brilliant player, but would, you know, I think Pulisic would have a good chance of getting in ahead of him. Ousmane Dembele has massive potential, but can't stop playing the PlayStation. So maybe Pulisic is getting in over him. So, like, England was the only one I looked through the squad, if we're talking about the squad rather than the team, and thought he wouldn't get in that.
You, to quote Meatloaf, you took the words right out of my mouth, Graham, with that statement. Thank you very much. And if he were to play on the left, lest we forget, Mason Mount would probably keep him out of the England team. And Kai Havertz would keep him out of the Germany team, most likely, wouldn't he? So there's a... Or he might do. I don't know. Joe, what do you think on this question?
I thought... I'm bailing you out here, Ryan.
Thank you.
I thought my initial answer was definitely not. And then I actually thought about it and looked, and it was a lot closer than I thought, right? I think that's kind of where a few of us are at here. I think he could crack a lot of the top teams, even France. I went through that exact same process, Graham. England is the biggest one that I don't know if he would make, right? I think for all the reasons that's already been stated. So, yeah, Christian Pulisic, pretty good. I do think as far as any U.S. men's national team player that would have the best chance to make any squad, it actually wouldn't be a defender for me on this U.S. team. It would be Gio Reyna. Because he is versatile, we're seeing him play as an 8 now for Dortmund instead of on the wing. He can play on the wing as well. We've seen that last season in the Bundesliga. We've seen it with the U.S. men's national team as well. I think because of that positional versatility, I think he's more versatile certainly than Pulisic. And he's also more physically imposing and can win battles and win 50-50 balls in midfield. I think Gio Reyna probably would crack any team in the world.
Including Borussia Dortmund.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. That's really interesting, Joe, because like, I think, I don't know if I agree with you about Reyna over Pulisic, but I will say that it's strange to think about the position and how big of an impact that is. And you're right, Reyna gives you versatility that you might need, whereas I do think Tyler Adams is the best player on the national team, at least right now. But the answer for him is like, no, he's definitely not making a bunch of different teams because so many countries have very good central midfielders, maybe less so wide attackers, maybe less so central attackers and playmakers. So yeah, I think it's between Pulisic and Reyna. I could see either one in that conversation.
Can I put forward Sergino Dest then at right back? Again, yeah. England is the one I'm thinking, you know, England have about nine of the 10 best right backs in the world at the moment. So again, maybe not England, but would he get in the France team that has, you know, Benjamin Pavard at right back? Probably. Italy, Florenzi started that tournament at right back. I think he's better than Florenzi. You know, I think there's a number of national teams that Sergino Dest would start at right back. So for me, he's the one I look through and I think, I don't know if he's better than Pulisic or Reyna, but he's the one that would get in the most national teams, in my opinion.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Is there a single player that would get into the England squad? Because even the only thing I would say that I can think of as a vulnerability is goalkeeper. And I think
Matt Turner, baby.
Hey, we got some good goalkeepers, but I think there is still the discussion of who will be the starting goalkeeper for the U.S. Joe and I both err on the side of Matt Turner, but I don't know if that would be good enough for him to then be starting for England. So that, like, that's the only, like, positional vulnerability I could think of. And even there, we don't have maybe the strength. So short of that, I think, yeah, maybe England is just the team that won't let in Americans.
So we've taken a question about Christian Pulisic and turned it into England are super stacked, aren't they great? I love that. Very good. Thank you very much.
And that's why you won the Euros.
We won it in spirit. We didn't horse collar anyone, Taylor. Anyway, let's take a break. We'll be back very shortly after these messages.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, Part 3, Listener Questions. Here we go with Martha Escobar, who asks, if you were suddenly drafted to be a Premier League referee for a regular league game, how long do you think it would take the players to figure out you were unqualified? What would give it away? The two assistant referees and the fourth official are in the know, they're in on this gag, and they're covering for you as much as possible. I love this scenario.
So good.
This question is triggering my imposter syndrome, by the way. That's basically my daily routine of figuring out when someone will work out I'm unqualified.
Yeah. You guys still haven't figured out I'm not a soccer broadcaster. We've been doing this for ages, so I've still got that one going. But in terms of being a referee, I have officiated, I think, maybe two kids games in which my kids were involved. It's really hard. I think I would be instantly found out within seconds is my answer. I think I could do like the fitness part of it. I was reading that referees can run between like 6 and 8 miles per game. I think I could handle that. My slight post-pandemic paunch might give me away as a referee perhaps. For me, I'm not getting away with any kind of subterfuge in that respect. Joe, I reckon you might be able to swing it.
Maybe. Ryan, you're so right, though. Like, where do you stand? I've watched so many soccer games in my life. Where do you stand at kickoff? I cannot think of the answer to that question. I hadn't even thought of that before we started. I was thinking I was going to get exposed, maybe not with, like, fouls and 50-50 duels in the run of play, because if you let it go, then everybody's like, oh, all right, the ref's just letting him play. So that part I think I could play off. The challenge for me is actually in the run of play, then where do I stand? So I don't know where to stand at kickoff. I don't know how referees almost always, 99% of the time, don't get in the way of the ball. Like, they never touch the ball, and I don't know where to go to be able to see what's happening. I don't know where I should be standing and moving and running. I think I could handle the running as well, Ryan. My positioning would really let me down. This is a hard thing. Referees have a hard job, guys.
They have a really hard job. Do you think, Joe, you could fake like the body language? Could you get that Graham Pole off your trot with you know, pushing away with the card in your hand? Could you do that?
I was thinking about what happens if it's a penalty call and I don't call it because I'm not going to call it, right? I don't know what's a penalty. I'm not going to be able to tell that. So I'm going to have to play it off. I was literally thinking about this morning. I'm going to have to play it off. And I was wondering, can I go toe to toe with a really angry Sergio Ramos? The answer is no. I'm melting in that moment. This is not going to go well for me, guys.
We're too much of a wallflower podcast. That's the problem, I think. Graham, in the UK, I was reading up, you can start refereeing at 14 years old. You can become a youth referee at 14 years old. And there are nine... I know. There's questions there. But you can go through nine levels, the ninth level, and get up to the first level, which is refereeing at Premier League level. It's kind of like, I think it's like Going Clear in Scientology, where you work through these levels, from what I can understand. But you have to apply for promotion through each tier. And you're examined in your matches, and you have to do at least one season at each level, Graham. So to me, that's telling me you need at least nine seasons of refereeing games, like every week, under your belt. Can you fake 9 years worth of refereeing every week, Graham?
Well, I mean, I faked 10 years of being a football writer, so probably. But I know I was joking about.
By the way, guys, I really love all of you publicly talking about how you're not qualified to be on the show and talk about soccer in one episode. Really good work. Really good work. Really enjoying this.
You're also modest.
Yeah, I was joking, obviously, about. No, I was going to say I was joking about who would be a kid referee. It's kind of strange thing to do, but honestly, see if you want to, if you have the foresight to be like, look, I'm not going to be good enough to be a player, but I want to put myself at the center of the action. Like, not a bad route to put, like, to be involved in professional soccer, because I can imagine the talent pool at 14 years old for referees is maybe not that deep. So. Yeah, I've totally changed my mind in the space of a minute. Like, a minute ago, I thought you were a weirdo if you're a 14-year-old referee. Now I'm thinking you're smarter than all of us. But yeah, I would definitely... Joe, you've now got me worried about where I would stand. I hadn't even thought about that. That is a nightmare. But I would also forget things. Like, when I played as a teenager, one of our referees forgot his whistle, so ended up just shouting things, going, free kick, throw in, corner kick. So if that was me, that'd probably give me away a little bit that I'm not a referee.
Taylor, you interviewed Simon Cooper, a really good interview on the TSS feed last week. In his book, his Barca book, I think he tells a story about Pep Guardiola stepping in to be a referee. Do you recall that anecdote?
That is in the other Barca book, but he's written a couple. But yes, that is the one where they didn't know it was Pep Guardiola. They just asked him, like, if anybody has any knowledge about soccer, and he was like, sure. And then he ended up coaching the youth players. So I think John Mueller was tweeting about that today.
Some game in New York during his time in New York, and like asking the parents, can anyone referee this game? This guy says, I can do it. And it turned out to be Pep Guardiola, and he kept stopping the game to coach the children halfway through, which to the chagrin of all the other parents watching. But he couldn't fake it.
Wait until they get the invoice.
Yeah, that's quite true. Taylor, could you do a better job than Pep at assimilating into the role?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right then.
You want more? So here is my actual answer is no. And for reasons similar to what Joe has mentioned, it's all of the protocol and procedure that I don't know. Like, I have played a ton of games. Push comes to shove, I'm not sure I could do the opening coin toss of like who says what and when, and like if you pick, do you have to select a side? Do you have to select ball? Like, there are refs who require you to select certain things, but even then, like, I think I would forget that I have a mic in my ear. I think I would forget that I have, like, the goal line technology watch, and I would be constantly like, who's talking to me? What's happening? So that stuff would be really, really, really challenging. I think the way I would go is to go with, I wrote his name down, Clésio Moreira dos Santos, the most flamboyant referee you will ever see. You all know the one I'm talking about from, it's a while back, but he's the one who does
the dancing ref.
Yeah, like the no, with the hand gestures. Like, Joe, again, to your point, I would just go way over the top because that's how you deal with Sergio Ramos. If you are just an absolute lunatic, he's not going to try to engage you in discourse about whether or not it was a penalty. He's going to be like, I don't know what this guy's deal is. So seriously? I would just go hard into like this guy clearly knows what he's doing because no beginner would act this way. I would just go straight to the ropes course.
Your strategy is to out lunatic Sergio Ramos. That's how you're getting through these games. Okay, fair enough. I look forward to seeing that.
It's going to go well. It's going to go well. I'm excited for it.
I think the idea, personally, maybe this speaks to my anxiety, but the idea of being a referee and having, 11 or 12 or even more people criticizing every decision I make, it really terrifies me. I can imagine myself like getting out onto the field. I don't have a coin. Can anyone lend me one to do the flip? Who's got a watch? It'd be like I'd be in my underwear. Yeah. It'd be one of those bad dreams. I don't think I could handle it very well at all. I think it takes a certain type of person to be able to do it, definitely.
Yep. Yeah, I would definitely end up like feeling bad that the other team is mad, and then I would probably be the one to give makeup calls and ruin games. So I don't want to be that official, so I will instead just go the lunatic route. That is my plan.
The lunatic route it is. Thank you very much, Martha, for that question. That was a great one. One last question for this show from Alex Latin, who says, I'm curious what the major European leagues are planning to do during the November-December period in 2022 when the old Qatar World Cup is going on, and how much time will the victors have to celebrate before they have to return to the mid-season grind? This is an aspect of the World Cup I hadn't really thought about, like the post-World Cup, when there might be some tired players out there. There's some players who've been going longer in that tournament than others. Gents, I've run some numbers and found some research on this, but Joe, what did you find about the situation in Europe's leagues where, next season? It's going to be a truncated and different season.
Yeah, probably not as different as I actually initially thought it was going to be, but I've read things like the BBC had a report or wrote a story about the 2022-23 Premier League season, and they said that it's likely going to start 1 week earlier in August and finish a week later in May. They've also proposed a winter break, the Premier League has. So that would have the games paused from November 12th all the way until December 26th, which is only 8 days after the World Cup final. So not a lot of rest for some of those players, although I'm sure they'll be eased back into those lineups. I saw a bit about the Bundesliga as well that had a similar idea, and that was something that they'd been talking about way back in 2018. But I genuinely couldn't find much for Ligue 1 or for La Liga or for Serie A. It makes logical sense for them to all follow a similar pattern. But I read a story in ESPN by Mark Ogden, and he was reporting that a lot of these leagues have gone and they've had COVID take priority in the immediate planning over really planning in depth for the next league season in a lot of these top leagues. And so Mark Ogden reported back in March that a resolution for the calendar for next season is unlikely to come fully until later this year. So we're going to hear little things, and we've already heard some things. But I would expect that starting earlier, ending later with a winter break for almost all of those leagues, even though I believe none of them have officially announced that as of yet.
I think the interesting bit for me is as you were talking about, Ryan, afterwards, like how quickly these players are going to come back. If it is 8 days after the World Cup final that the Premier League in particular is coming back, because obviously the 26th of December, Boxing Day, in the UK is like this treasured tradition in English football. So I don't think people will be happy if there's no games on Boxing Day. I actually won't be happy, despite everything, despite the fact that the sensible decision would be not to have soccer on that day. Boxing Day is like the best football day for me, so I would be unhappy not to have any football. So you face a scenario like this kind of MLS type situation where you have maybe fixtures going ahead without some of the big name players taking part, but not you, Pedri, though. You're playing every game. In fact, Barca and Spain are going to arrange some more games for you just to keep you sharp.
Yeah. In those 8 days, Pedri's going to play some exhibition games every day just to keep him sharp. You're quite right there. But it is amazing. I was reading that FIFA have suggested that players must be allowed to join their national teams by or on November 14th. The World Cup kicks up on November 21st. That's not a lot of time to get assimilated with your respective squads there. And the Premier League's, from what I can see, the fixtures are going to run up until that weekend of November 12th and 13th. So the 14th is the Monday. So then they all fly off to Qatar to start proceedings there. That's a quick turnaround there. But I think, Taylor, because this is a mid-season World Cup of sorts, maybe there's less need for rest, if that makes sense, because they'll be very much in the swing of things. They'll have the summer off before this tournament starts. Almost all of them will, unless they're put on pointless exhibition tournaments, which they inevitably will be. What else did you find, Taylor?
That it's really stupid to have a Winter World Cup. Is that a useful answer? Because I do want to point out that this is not what Qatar bid. When they bid for the World Cup, they were awarded the World Cup on the promise that they would host it in the summer, that they would be able to accommodate the heat, that they would have air-conditioned stadiums and all the other things, and then immediately said, yeah, we're not doing that. We need to move the World Cup. And I just, like, I want to point that out to say that this is, once again, an example of FIFA creating their own problems. And there is an idea that with the pandemic and everything getting pushed back, it does work in their favor because there's games that can now happen when they wouldn't have been able to because the World Cup would have been in the summer. But it's still, that's very much not a thing that they could have seen coming. They could have seen that disrupting every single soccer season is going to cause problems and create confusion. And you're right, Ryan, maybe having that summer off will mean that they're not as fatigued. But I also think to go to, for the players that do get to go, it is a global party. And though they will not be partying and going out every night, it's not the Olympic Village, but it's, I cannot imagine how difficult it would be to go play in a World Cup and then come back to, you know, regular season and up. Oh, we still got like 6 months to go before this one's over and we're 10th in the table. Awesome. Like it's, I just think it'll be interesting and it's an interesting time and there can be interesting stuff that can happen, but I'm still fundamentally annoyed about that. And then obviously many, many other things when it comes to Qatar hosting the World Cup.
One of my favorite things about Qatar's bid was when they were going to have artificial clouds. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right.
Like, I know the bid, it was a long time between the bid process and the actual World Cup taking place, but I feel like maybe they underestimated like what the future was going to look like. By 2022, we were going to have artificial clouds.
Yeah. I like to think they just sat down and were like, look, so everyone knows magic is real and we have the ability to control clouds. Like that is the only thing that I can picture. Cause yeah, I think it involved missiles and they were like blowing up clouds to send them elsewhere. It felt like how you start a post-apocalyptic movie is we're going to disrupt the atmosphere missiles. And see what happens.
I just can imagine FIFA going to Qatar. How do you plan on doing that? And they're like, yeah, missiles. Missiles. You can do anything with missiles.
To blow up the sun. It's going to work really well.
I guess the moral is don't award World Cups based on technology that does not yet exist. Probably a good guideline. We've spoken a lot about what the Premier League will do. It looks like the Championship, the English second tier, is going to also take a break. That's good news for all the Arsenal players who'll be going to the World Cup, so they'll be able to get a break and come straight back to their league afterwards. Leagues 1 and League 2 are going to power through. The Bundesliga, they're going to treat it, as I understand, as a longer winter break. And they're going to have more English Wochen, which is English weeks, which is what they call weeks that have midweek games in them. So they're going to have 12 to 16 consecutive English Wochen in the Bundesliga. And my research, according to...
That's such a passive-aggressive name for that.
Yeah, I mean, are the English the only league that did they pioneer midweek fixtures? Is that what it is?
It should be MLS, man. It should be named after MLS. We can't go a day without an MLS game.
Those MLS games used to be my favorites. The ones that were like 2 p.m. on a Wednesday. Those were the days. Those were the days. But speaking of MLS, they're actually going to move their season so it finishes in January just so they can play through a major tournament such as to keep up with traditions as well. Anybody else find anything else about the schedules for research-wise? Taylor, anything else from you, sir?
Just that I couldn't find anything else similar to Joe for some of the other leagues. And I think that does go back to COVID and the need for flexibility. And we have confederations that are still figuring out how World Cup qualifying is going to work, let alone what their domestic fixtures are going to look like when the World Cup rolls around in 2022. So I think we will have more clarity in the near future. But I think the answer is basically they're going to give them a break. Some leagues will give them more of a break before and after, some less. And then they're going to add some time on at the beginning and end of the season. That's pretty much the generic answer.
If they can invent clouds in Qatar, can they invent a way to like not have clouds and rain every day in Manchester?
Yeah, they just transport it over. They just ship it.
Oh, they just move them. They just push them.
Or just invent another month to have the World Cup in.
Or just make reverse missiles.
If I wanted to be courteous... reverse missiles. Joe, I love you so much. I would remind everyone that the Japan bid was that they would have everybody equipped with, I think it was like motion sensing technology, every single player, and that would allow them to do hologram broadcasts so that you could watch like the U.S. play. Even though they're playing in Japan, you could go to your like a stadium that was equipped for this and you could watch the hologram of the players on the pitch. That is what Japan said they would be able to do. I don't think that technology exists either. So I'm starting to realize that World Cup bidding is just lying, though. It's just lying. That's all it is.
Oh, that's so cool.
They did bring Tupac back. That was the early... God, I hope that's true. I hope that was the early part of this technology. It was like, just in case we get this bid, we got to start working on this, guys.
They were the Japanese 2002 World Cup committee finally invented this technology and thought, who should we contact? Tupac.
That's the one we need.
Oh, this conversation's taking a turn.
I mean, he's alive in Cuba. We all know this. So, like, let's just go get him and see if he'll be a hologram. Why not?
This feels like a good spot to jump off this listener questions episode, guys. Thank you very much to Alex for that question. Thank you to everybody who sent their questions in, indeed. And Taylor Wokrell, thank you to you, sir, hologram or otherwise.
I am a real me, but real Graham will not be with us next week. Real Graham is going on vacation for the first time in, I think, 18 years. So I just wanted to say, listeners, thank you all for listening, but also Graham, enjoy your vacation, my friend.
Thank you. I will. I'll get Japan to send a hologram of me.
That's good.
As long as the hologram and not a missile, that's fine.
Yeah. Graham, if you're on vacation, will you cut down to sort of 8 to 10 games a day of watching?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe 12, you know. Let's not be too drastic here.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And Joe Lowry, thank you so much for your contribution, sir, and your reverse missiles. I'm still trying to imagine what that is.
Anytime, Ryan.
Thank you, listener. We'll be back soon. Bye!